With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
You're with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Media Matters time now with Marty Gibson. It's been a day, Marty. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good.
It's good to have you back again for another week. And we've got a lot to chew over this week, actually. There's been a lot going on. And let's kick things off, I think. Let's start with, it's Kiwi Music Month. And I've put lots of Kiwi music into the show this week. But musicians have found something else to get themselves exercised over this month, not just music.
Yeah. They're all up in arms about gold mining in the Coromandel. You know, like a lot of things in the paper, this is kind of a bit of Green Party activism that's getting a lot of free column inches and isn't really being presented as such.
Because they had their vision, the Green Party vision. It was all about saving the planet, let alone, like, well, that's really nice. Very nice, Greens, Chloe, Marma. But let's actually save the country first, eh?
I think it's more primal than that. I think that what's going on with those Green Party MPs, and they're mostly women at this stage, the prominent ones, you know, I've characterised Julianne Genta's outburst at that lady who said, hey, look at this empty cycle lane and my business is having to close, then got grabbed and shaken. You know, and I've said it before, it's narcissistic rage. You know, it's how dare you contradict the way I like to see myself as this eco-warrior who's saving everyone. And if you sort of characterise yourself as all good because you haven't done the shadow work because you're a young MP and so you've just had to go vote for me and talk about how great you are, you start believing your press. In order to characterise yourself as good, you've got to characterise those against you or who disagree with you as evil. And so that's what we're seeing, you know, where you've got this mining company talking about some of what they're doing. The potential, because New Zealand's bush, even though it looks pristine, ecologically is pretty screwed by rats and stoats and possums. And so you've got this mining company saying, you know, they're doing these additional programs. We will fund an intensive pest and predator eradication program until 2015, covering nearly 19,000 hectares and killing pigs, ferrets, and other pests that eat the frogs and other wildlife. So there's a lot of good stuff that you could do with that sort of money. And I think, I'm just looking for the cover here, but it's something like $6.5 billion worth of gold that they can mine.
And it's not open cast mining either. I think they're looking at...
The objection is they're drilling a tunnel under and there's going to be some blasting and the vibration could upset the frogs. And there's also, they're sticking some air vents on a paper road. And, you know, they've demanded that these air vents are demolished after the mining's completed. But I think that's part of the anti-human thing that the Greens have got going on as well. It's so cool walking through bush and coming upon an artifact like that.
Mm.
You know, it's that idea that nature and humans can't coexist. And it might at some point be useful to have a huge underground network of tunnels that people can go and get into.
Well, and of course, we can always ask Shane Jones to get comment from Freddie the Blind Frog on this to see whether or not there's anything to be said there. But again, you know, we're going to dive into this a little bit later on in terms of the brain drain across to Australia and you know, record numbers now of New Zealanders going across to Australia. And part of the reason they're going over there is because it's wealthier, it's better. You've spent some time there recently. And the reason for that is they're not afraid of digging their stuff up. They're digging gold up. They're digging minerals up. They're digging, I mean, they've got all that uranium in the middle of the country that they dig up. They're not afraid to actually do that, to grow the overall pot and wealth of their nation, whereas in this country, heaven forbid, if there's a snail or a frog in the way, it gets musicians all exercised and says, no, we can't do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is the frogs and snails are getting hammered by these pests. So, you know, the mining activity that results in that 19,000 acres having pest control done within it would result in a net gain. But, again, that's not the point. The point is that these people. And it had a story about the guy who started it, and he had something to do with some music festival. And there's a sort of a profile shot of him. He looks like he's about 7 months pregnant. People who need to see themselves as heroic, but don't necessarily want to do anything except stop something happening. It's not an active kind of heroism. It's a put the brakes on heroism. And, you know, you had old John Tumahiri is involved in it as well. And so, yeah, again, this is a Green Party, bit of Green Party political activism. And for John Tumahiri, it's an opportunity to hate Whitey. We do not oppose mining per se, but we oppose arrogant foreign multinationals exhibiting cavalier attitudes, Tumahiri said. That means we'll take your money, but you're going to assume your correct position as obedient to our mana. What kills me, without wanting to jump around too much, you know, we've also starting to get this stuff coming out about the orgy of cash spigot that Labor indulged themselves in. And Kāinga Ora's debt is $26 billion. And they're starting to have to talk about the elephant in the room, which is all of this money that the Marxist student politicians borrowed was at near 0% interest. Well, now the banks are doing the magic trick of turning fake money into real estate, and the interest rates are getting jacked up. That's adding to the cost. So the report found that operating deficits in Kāinga Ora were forecast to grow from $520 million in 22-23 to over $700 million in 26-27. So, you know, this $26 billion of debt is coincidentally four times the amount of the total value of the gold that's going to be extracted by this mining operation that they don't want. Maybe if they'd protested some of the profligate spending that didn't get much done, wouldn't need to. We'd have the flexibility maybe not to mine.
Yeah. It's that, I mean, it's insane. Like, it's absolutely insane the amount of money that it's cost. But none of us, I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I can just see Robbo. I put it in Kiwi Farm today that Squitter handed over the keys to the grain silo to the Department of Paddocks and Pens, the DPP, as I called it, and said, help yourself as long as you make me look good. That's pretty much what it was.
And the media still seems determined to make them look good. They've got, like, even as old Adam Pearce is writing the story about this blowout, he's still saying the last government's affordable housing scheme Kiwi built. It's kind of like, it clearly wasn't affordable, Adam.
No.
You know, but they're still using Comrade Cindy's wonder communication smoking cessation bill, you know, that's totally impractical and won't do what it says, but we're still going to call it that. So you're opposing the smoking cessation bill.
And knowing someone that works in that space would visit up there, and they were doing contracts for these Kiwi build homes because they're, you know, they're everywhere in Auckland, and you would have these big tranches of housing, and they were told that for Kiwi build they have to come in under a certain level. That's fine. So they would build these homes to standard healthy home standards, because a lot of as well as first home buyers, you also had lots of investors that were going in and buying these homes to rent out. So of course you've got a set of standards that they have to maintain. Well, the Kiwi build homes were actually had a set of standards that were higher than the healthy home standards. So then they would then submit the plans and say, right, these are the eight townhouses we're looking at building. Four of them are going to be Kiwi build and four of them are going to go out to the open market. AO would then come back and say, no, on four, these four, no, they need to have triple glazing, not double glazing. They need to have this level of insulation. They've got to have this level of soundproofing, a jib. They've got to have this amount of carpeting and all of these extra, more expensive items. And of course, it would blow the cost out above the, I think it was $650,000 threshold to the sale price. A developer's got to make a margin in there, right? And so what would end up happening is that in order to meet it, they would then have to apply difference between the KO cost onto the, hopefully pick it up on the other four properties that sold. But if that didn't happen, and this is what was happening, is that they'd go and put these things all out onto the market and they weren't selling. So they'd go out, they put them on the market, the price would go on them, and that you'd have these four at KO, it's 600,000 for KiwiBuild, and then four identicals, which were more. And of course, people are like, well, why are these ones more when these ones are 650,000? But that was okay, because KO said, was all right, because if it doesn't sell, we'll just buy all of them.
Yeah,
that's what
and that happened time and time again.
I
heard about a guy, who was a CEO of a Māori health authority, and a lot of his family got told during COVID to start businesses and start applying for these contracts, which were had often very flimsy deliverables. And one of this guy's relatives made pod houses, and he said, hey, how much for one of those pod houses? And he said, oh, 11,000. He said, oh, make them 22,000. So he did. Did you read that article? Actually, it was in Monday's paper, where there was a headline, "Less Scrutiny of Government Spending Concerns Auditor General," by Jenny Tibshirani. She could be a hobbit, Jenny. The Office of the Auditor General is ringing alarm bells over falling accountability of government spending. Now, so far reading that, you'd think, wow, Nationals is the falling in their accountability. But when you read it, it's about what Labor was doing. But it's not characterised that way. It's not saying Labor were a bunch of dopes who just threw standard operate financial prudence out the window because they thought they were right.
Well, that's okay, because Hipkins unveils his Labor vision, according to Thomas Coughlin. Chris Hipkins told Labor members at the Auckland conference that he envisages a party getting back into power in 2 years and then spending a decade building a strong economy, boosting education and healthcare, overseeing a boom in new house construction, and ushering in a vibrant multicultural society.
Yeah.
Oh, bless. I actually called this the Arsonist Manifesto, actually, because, you know, let's face it, they're very, very, very good of dousing anything that they touch with accelerant and then flicking a match to it and then pretending they want to come in and put it out, when really they just like to stand around, hold their hands up going, oh, hope you're not too hot. Oh, no, it's all right. No, we'll just put a bit more wood on the fire, shall we? Yeah.
Well, the problem isn't that you've got narcissists who are willing to do that. And you think about the hide you'd have to be Chris Hipkins still sticking himself out there. Like he is. Everything he touched turned to crap.
Mm.
Everything. The number of things he just cocked up. And he was one of the more competent people in that muddle-headed team.
My favourite quote in here is mega landlords. Mega landlords would pay their fair share of tax, while a sustained boom in housing construction has seen an increasing number of Kiwis able to realise their dreams of owning their own home, he said. Now, what is the number one landlord in the country? Aangaroa.
Yeah, well, I mean, that article about the Auditor General had some horrendous stuff. The Auditor General didn't investigate the appropriateness of every MYA. Now, an MYA is a multi-year appropriations. So it's a way of kind of saying we're going to spend this money. Didn't investigate the appropriateness of every MYA, but highlighted a $12.7 billion envelope allocated to Kāinga Ora, homes and communities between budgets 2022 and 2023. This is when they kind of knew they were going to lose, and they're just given a hospital pass for a Crown lending facility. It said there were insufficient performance measures attached to this funding, making it difficult for the government to be held to account for what the spending achieves. It was tucked away on A20 of Monday's paper. It's tucked right near the back. Furthermore, fewer than 3 minutes were dedicated to scrutinising the massive $12.7 billion appropriation. 3 minutes. During a select committee meeting of members of parliament aimed at addressing money allocated outside of the budget process. The money that they've spent, that's $90,000 to $100,000, depending on who you listen to. Some people say it's more of extra government debt we've got now. Yeah, the interest rates are getting jacked up on that. And it's going to squeeze us. There were a couple of voices of reason in the paper. I thought, as usual, Heather DePussy-Allen and Stephen Joyce as well.
That's what I'm just leaning over to get with. There's both of them, yeah, indeed. And Heather DePussy-Allen actually covered the brain drain because, of course, the other number that came out was, what are we now, May? So April was the biggest net loss of New Zealanders leaving for Australia ever.
Yeah.
Which is a lot. And, I mean, she was right. I mean, she what she covered off, where is it? Where are you, Heather? There you are. So some of the things that she looked at were 52, so this is in a year, 52,000 Kiwis have gone to Australia. Well, that's Napier. All of Napier has packed up and gone to Australia. The largest net loss, as I said, was in last month. And the biggest thing that got me was, and I mean, you can see where they're going, it's a 32% pay gap.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, if my boys are of an age and they were trying to get on the ladder and get themselves started, I'd be packing their bags for them.
Bruce Cottrell said that, you know, was talking about how the government was saying they didn't have the money to pay police. And he said, they're going to have to find it. And they are. You know, you can't lose, especially when you consider that the ones who get up and go tend to be the ones with the get up and go.
Yeah.
It's like refining crude oil. You know, you get all the volatiles leaving and you get left with the tar.
And then, of course, you know, the fact that Queensland and Northern Territory have been actively recruiting our police for over a year. New South Wales have now joined in on the party, which Heather brought up in her column. But not only that, I mean, it's the nurses that are going in absolute droves. And then our favourite arsonist, the little ginger himself, Hipkins, he made it easier for all of them to stay with a new pathway for citizenship after 8 years. I mean, really? But that's okay. He's quite toasty warm.
So she's saying we have a serious brain drain underway, and yet we don't seem too worried about it. Certainly not nearly as much as we collectively were about the brain drain in the mid-aughts, which whipped up so much concern that John Key used it as a plank to his 2008 campaign. Perhaps the reason we're not stressing is because we don't begrudge our fellow Kiwis leaving. The mood in New Zealand is gloomy, politicians on both sides are angry, everything is broken from the education system to the justice system. And there is that feeling, isn't there? It's just kind of you've got these activists telling you to bugger off the whole time if you object to their ethno-nationalism. And her summary of how to close the gap is valid as well. How to close the gap is not a puzzle. We know what to do. The 2025 Task Force wrote a report on it more than a decade ago. It recommended slashing government spending, cutting taxes, reducing beneficiary numbers, raising the pension age, selling state-owned assets, and vigorously encouraging foreign investment. So we're just getting started on that now.
Yeah, no.
To a great hue and cry from the country's soon-to-be unemployed journalists.
And it's just the weight of, because that's the other thing with Australian being a federalised system with all the different states, because you can actually pick the state that works for you. You know, some people love the sunshine in Queensland and what goes on there. Other people prefer Victoria or New South Wales. I mean, Victoria, you can pretty much end up with more of the same as we have here. But the other thing that Joyce, he covered off that as well, is he said here, it's already happening, just to follow on from what Duke C. Allen said, it's already happening. As a result of the past 5 or 6 years of economic mismanagement, we now have record numbers of New Zealanders voting with their feet and moving to Australia and further afield. And need I remind you, Australia is cutting taxes with a Labor government, no less.
Mm. Yeah, I thought he made an eloquent defence of tax cuts as well. You know, we're sort of characterising this as tax cuts for the rich rather than an adjustment to tax brackets, which have steadily ground away the disposable income of Kiwis through inflation. And inflation is just another form of tax. All this money that Robbo and Adrian Orr conspired to print is a tax, because it means that the government takes all of this money, and it means that the money that we're left with is worth less.
And everybody, well, when I say a lot of the opinion writers are doing, you know, casting Nicola Willis and Luxon as evil for wanting these tax cuts. Vernon Small had a crack at it, and there were a couple of others that did. But then the Taxpayers Union, as Stephen Joyce said, 74% of New Zealanders actually want the tax thresholds adjusted for inflation, which is just makes sense. And just to remind everybody, remember, so 17.5% tax from $14,000 onwards, 30 cents per dollar of the dollar from $48,000 onwards, and it's been like that since 2010, 33 cents in the dollar from $70,000 onwards, with the wage growth a year alone, so what is it, 24-25% over labour in the 6 years, minimum wages went up. If you're on minimum wage, working a 40-hour week, just standard minimum wage, currently right now you're at $48,152, 40-hour week, minimum wage. Hello? I mean, think about that for a second. That puts you now, you've been paying 17.5% tax up until that. Anything extra that you earn over and above that nearly doubles. It goes from 17.5% to 30% in tax. How uninspiring is that for those who are on the lowest wages? Because they'll be looking at that thinking, well, so if I get a job that pays me this little bit extra, that little bit extra, more than double, it's going to get taken away from me again. It is a really uninspired creep. And the cost of living, and that's without the 15% blanket GST we pay over everything that we do. It's difficult. There is a working poor out there. If you're in that bracket who are earning that sort of $48,000 to $55,000 a year, and you're having to pay on that $15,000 and $5,000 of that, you're only getting to keep 10.
Yeah.
You'd look at it thinking, why do I bother?
Well, you look at it and think, well, I could make a lot more going on the dole or going on a sickness benefit and selling a bit of pee. Someone was telling me the other day that's strategy the mob use. They get solo mums hooked on pee and then get them selling pee.
That's
part of it. There was also an article about inflation costs eating away at hospo profits. I mean, there are a lot of businesses that are just stretched so much, and hospo is probably the cutting edge of that stretchedness, isn't it?
Oh, totally, totally. And then you look at, you know, what they tried to do in Auckland with the parking charges. I mean, downtown Auckland, what a joke.
Mm.
And what did I hear yesterday morning? Stats New Zealand. And is it Grey Street? Yeah, I think it's Grey Street or Grey Road property are not renewing their lease after the end of the year when it's up, because so many of their staff and quote unquote feel unsafe going to work or even going out for lunch in the inner city. So therefore, they are saying, well, feel free to work from home if you feel unsafe, and we're not going to renew our lease.
I mean, I've talked about this before in the health sector. You know, there's this thing of morale. And it's real hard to measure. You can survey it, but it has all sorts of knock-on effects. If you've got a team of doctors and nurses that feel that management's got their back, you know, they're supporting each other, they get incredible work done. They'll get through so much. Once that's gone, and, you know, with each nurse that leaves and people getting their leave cancelled and just feel they're getting taken advantage of, that morale goes, you get the productivity of the people who are left dropping as well as the people who aren't there. Each person that leaves has an exponential effect in terms of the strain that the system's under. And that's the same with police too. You know, if you need a police force that finds that whole idea that people can't go to work absolutely unacceptable. To the point where they're personally affronted by it. But if they feel that management don't have their back, if they're too mean to the people who are committing these crimes, that rather than management back them up, they're going to be all over them and just hang them out to dry, surprise, surprise, it's not going to get dealt with.
No. And Joyce sort of, there was a real theme of sort of the...
We could stick with that for a while, because he said a lot of interesting...
He did, with the whole give and take on that theme. So he said here, the argument goes a little like this, and this is in regards to pulling things together. The argument goes a little like this. If we're to lift ourselves out of our economic doldrums, we'll have to grow our way out. And that will only happen if we rebalance our economy in favour of rewarding effort rather than distribution. We need people with the get up and go to work harder and smarter and earn more in the real terms for doing so. And as you said, part of that is staff morale. And then there was three stories across the weekend talking about 4-day weeks, productivity, and burnout.
Mm.
And it's that whole sort of balance. Then you look at the public service, and there's also a balance and mix match between, I heard with Kāinga Ora, right? They interviewed Chris Bishop about that yesterday, and he was saying about all the things that they're going to do coming off the report. And they said, well, what about the CEO? I mean, you know, the Kai Whakahaere at the top of this shitty. And his exact words were, "Is I'm not responsible for the hiring of the CEO.
Mm.
And when he said that, it just struck me. I thought, well, that kind of makes sense now with so many of these government departments, whereas departments themselves, they are being, I think, quite obtrusive and deliberately so in blocking progress that the ministers are trying to, in this coalition agreement that they're trying to roll forward and make happen.
Yeah. I've speculated that before, you know, that there are a lot of those public servants who are being given instructions to cut costs, and so they're cutting costs in ways that they know aren't going to play well for the government. Cutting costs to help parents of severely disabled children. Cutting fair go. You know, cutting things that it's like, you know, the characterization of any cut to this 80% splurgy increase in public sector spending is going to cut frontline services.
And then you have the Department of Internal Affairs after the submissions roll back the internet restrictions around, you know, what can be broadcast and what can be on the internet. And lo and behold, in the first segment after Sunday gets taken off air, what do you have? A two-year-old rerun of that piece of farrier trash, The Web of Chaos.
God.
Did it age well? I saw it first time round. I didn't bother the second time round, but you saw it. Did it age well, Marty?
Oh, just however much contempt we hold these people in, it's not enough. And again, it gets back to that, I'm a narcissist, I'm good, good people think this way, anyone who thinks differently is evil. And the ends justify the means. It's that upturned fist of socialism where violence is justified against class enemies. And speaking of Department of Internal Affairs, did you see they were boasting that they'd had a big boost to their revenue by people fast-tracking their passport applications?
So, yeah, because of their inefficiency.
I want to get the hell out of here, but faster.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting slow at processing them, so people are just paying us to fast track them.
I know.
Like, yeah, that's a false economy, guys.
Just insanity. Absolute insanity.
The bit I took out of the Stephen Joyce, it's Bruce Cottrell level highlighting. So yeah, I thought it was really interesting that he was a contrast to Liam Dan. And my impression of Liam Dan is maybe he did Economics 101 and he's just been milking it for columns ever since. He's a big believer in monetary theory, is our Liam. And he's very much, they've got to keep interest rates high because if they don't, people might spend more and that will drive inflation. Whereas a more correct way of looking at it is the government's effectively taxed the population of New Zealand by printing all of these hundreds of billions of dollars, which has reduced the value of our money. And so in order to, as Adrian Orr says, it's a great business to be in because we print money and people think it has value. So in order to get people to think it has value, they've got to increase the cost of it.
Yeah.
It's wholly artificial. But he said, there is another group, I'm looking at you, sundry economists and fellow traveling economic commentators, who say tax cuts would be inflationary, and indeed they could be if they increased the rate of government borrowing through what is known as fiscal impulse. However, nobody expects the government will continue to increase government borrowing at the record-breaking rate Grant Robertson managed to over the past 6 years. It is instead bound to shrink, so that is largely a non-starter. I just can't stand the sight of these bankers twisting their hair into pigtails and saying, well, we've just got to keep interest rates up while we're banking these eye-watering record profits.
Yeah, but don't worry about it, Adrian. You can have as much as you like as long as you make me look good.
Yeah, the parasite is so close to killing the host here.
Yeah,
both the government and the banking system.
He went on to say a bigger danger is probably on the downside. I'd wager the Reserve Bank governor is at risk of going too large for too long on the inflationary shutdown and a mirror image of the way the bank overtook the economic stimulus during COVID. You think? But this time underestimating the impact of the current entirely necessary cutback in government spending. If there is to be a boost in the consumer spending as a result of the upcoming tax cuts, it may turn out to be very timely for the wider economy. And again, this is another thing that Robbo and crew did to screw the pooch, is they gave that numpty, what was it, another six-year term, 5 or 6 year term, literally as they were getting spanked on the ass out the door because they knew they were leaving, so they appointed him for another term.
He of the sacred tree and the morning karakia, yeah. Unbelievable. And you know, it's quite funny, though, to see, you can see the journalists still kind of starting to think, oh, well, things are going bad. I can break with orthodoxy a little bit. I saw Tova O'Brien, Jenna, doing a I for One Welcome Our New Insect Overlords piece on Nicola Willis. And just, you know, the funny thing is, just how anti-women these lefty journalists are toward women in power.
Towards women in general, Marty, not just women in power.
Yeah, but you know, rather than, you know, it sort of tries to fit her into that, you know how I've said before that the biggest crime Luxon makes is not giving these 30, 40-something female journalists the tingles, or in the case of female politicians, not remind them of their friends who they drink wine with. And so she's trying to sort of push Nicola Willis into that rather than asking her, you know, questions she'd ask a man, you know, ideas on philosophy, what historical events have influenced her. It starts out, this is, I think this is in Canvas. It's Sunday Herald, I think.
The magazine-y thing in the paper.
Yeah, it's a magazine-y thing. And this is from, seems to be done through Stuff. So it starts off, Nicola Willis wants a puppy.
That's right.
You know, just the patronizing. And it's just kind of, I've interviewed Nicola Willis more times than I can remember. Our exchanges tend to be on the side of robust, but this time we agree to set aside our usual roles in an attempt to get to know and better understand the woman Sir John Key tells me could one day be Prime Minister. It's like, well, is it even your job to be that adversarial, Tova? And if so, where was that adversarial, inquisitorial style of journalism with Comrade Cindy? Tova? Tova? Yes, Jenna. Yes, Tova. Tova. It weren't there. She does come across well through this. And I do, she comes across as a policy wonk in her communication. And Richard Preble made that point. You know, there are things like with her social investment that haven't got the journalistic cut through because she still sounds like a policy wonk. She's saying things in a very, like Luxon, all features, no benefits.
Yeah. I think what Willis's greatest crime with these female journalists are is that at high school, Willis was the one who was never sort of in the cool kids club, wasn't doing the drama club, wasn't doing all the things that made you look really fantastic and fabulous at school. She was the one that was head down, bum up, doing all the work.
Well, it says here she was turning the power off and smoking cigarettes and smoking weed, so a bit of street cred.
Yeah, so, you know, it's very, I glanced through that and I thought to myself, gosh, Tova, this is so high school, really?
You know what I thought? I thought, Tova, this is so you trying to get a job as a press secretary or or communications consultant.
Can we pivot? I'm just looking at time. Can we pivot? Because I wouldn't mind talking just a touch before we jump into feedback, because we have actually got quite a bit of feedback this week. Just a touch on the coronial findings with Rory Meehan, which I know everyone has been talking about, and Paul will be certainly covering this. And there was, again, actually an article in the paper around coronial inquiries in the Sunday Star Times, which have dropped by a third. Like, they're just not being done. There's only a couple of dozen coronial inquiries that are actually completed in a year. They're being held up 21. Primarily.
Yeah, was it 21 coronial inquiries?
21 coronial inquiries. And one of the reasons they believe they've been held up is because now lawyers are getting involved more.
Yeah, the numbers were eye-watering, weren't they?
The numbers were incredibly. I mean, one family has been waiting a decade, decade for the coronial inquiry. So the fact that the Nairn inquiry has come through after 3 years is a miracle. Most of them on average seem to be waiting at least 5. Some of the big takeaways from the Nairn inquiry, obviously, were the fact that the pharmacy was sort of released from any blame. And the overarching blame was the tsunami of information that apparently came out from the Ministry of Health, which then made it incredibly difficult for any vaccinator, whether that be a doctor, a nurse vaccinator, or hairdresser vaccinator, depending on who you went to, or pharmacist, to decipher what information needed to be provided to a patient to apply informed consent.
You were saying there was a tsunami of information advising sent to providers about the vaccine, including 12 updates within 3 weeks. Information about myocarditis was embedded in the information. The operating guidelines for the vaccination in September 2021 included an information and consent pack, which included what to expect. Now, I looked up because I was trying to find Jacinda Ardern's speech telling people to talk to their GPs, because actually they're the ones who know you best, which came soon after she'd threatened GPs with deregistration if they contradicted.
That was in April.
Yeah, right. Well, in October, she gave a speech which said, the vaccine we're using in New Zealand is safe and effective. If you're vaccinated, it means that you're less likely to catch the virus and much less likely to end up in hospital if you do. It also helps protect everyone. It didn't. The more people who are vaccinated, the harder it is for COVID to spread through communities quickly and find our most vulnerable. That means while we used to say that we needed to stay home to save lives, we now need to be vaccinated to save lives. Mm-hmm. Sorry, vaccinated.
Because MedSafe issued the warning against myocarditis on July 21st, and they were saying, oh, but that was 5 months after the rollout started.
Now very rare.
But we all know that July 2021 was still only the first thrust of people going through to be vaccinated. So by that, I think it was medical professionals and stuff were May, June, and July was that next sort of wave. So it was right at the very beginning. And it wasn't until, I think, the November after the death of Rory that Ashley Bloomfield then put out another statement from the Ministry of Health saying, oh, this could actually be a concern. And that was after, of course, the horse had bolted. Now, those of us that did our own research and actually looked into this, we were aware of this at the time because we were there. But there's no discussion in this of the media culpability on this, but also, too, no discussion, as you said, of the letters that went out to all those different bodies. And essentially, the messaging was, if you were putting a needle in an arm, what you were to tell those that patient is this safe and effective. And worse than that, there was a fact sheet that went out to all vaccinators, a pictorial, beautiful pictorial fact sheet that went out on how to address vaccine hesitancy. If your patient had questions and concerns about vaccination, how you were able to convince them, let them know that there were no issues. And worse than that, at the bottom of that sheet, it was brought to you and sponsored by Pfizer.
Unbelievable. There's going to be a few rear guard actions like this.
Yeah.
Where you're going to see a little minor admission. McDowell, and it sounds like she was the coroner, I think. McDowell pointed out none of the official information sources explicitly required vaccinators to inform consumers about the risk of myocarditis before vaccination, and the importance of new information was not communicated to vaccination providers. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got them claiming that, you know, there was this avalanche of information. But on the other hand, you had, you know, these people had just been told to be deregistered if they contradicted what I just quoted Jacinda Ardern is saying. It's safe and effective.
This is a comment from a pharmacist. I did COVID training. We were specifically told not to scare people off getting their vax, and that the risk of myocarditis was far greater from the infection than the vaccination. Regardless, the heavy media propaganda that it was safe and effective, it wouldn't have mattered what any pharmacist had said. People were worried about losing their jobs. It makes me so angry. And that was, the coroner did bring that up, that they acknowledged the undue pressure applied to Kiwis to be vaccinated, which was something that came out from Nairn's parents. And I just look at the blood scandal, the UK blood scandal that's now breaking in the last few days. And if you want to know what a yardstick is, to when some people say, will we ever get justice over this vaccination issue, over the harms that are caused? Well, if you want a yardstick, that blood scandal, and my husband remembers it from when he worked in the United Kingdom. In the he was there, he worked there twice. He was there in the late 90s, and then he was there in the early 2000s. He said, you know, that was massive. Everybody knew about it. They all knew about the harms. And this is contaminated blood products that hadn't gone through proper screening, which then gave haemophiliacs primarily, but also other people, hepatitis C and HIV through the period of the late 70s, 80s. And it was just literally all swept under the rug. And every time tried to sort of bubble up again, it would get suppressed and bogged down. A huge report's now come out highlighting what an absolute shit show it was. So if you want to know the yardstick for the truth to get out, it seems to be around 30-ish years, because that's enough time for all of the perpetrators of whatever this crime is to either be long gone, out of dodge, or dead.
Yeah, and it is a long game. You know, I think a lot of people in the freedom community, if you want to call it that, got burned out by trying to sprint what is essentially a marathon. There's one other thing. I mean, it was kind of a news cycle of extremes in some ways, wasn't it? It's sort of, I don't just mean in terms of how you might think about extremism, you know, terrorists and violence. It's a form of that narcissism that doesn't allow for nuance. You know, there's people taking a position that they're absolutely right. There's a bit of wind back. You know, there's rebel, an excerpt, in Canvas, the Weekend Herald, where Rebel Wilson talks about being 49, unmarried and childless and going to fertility clinics. There's another one in the Daily Mail, Petronella Wyatt, I'm single, childless and alone. Feminism has failed me and my generation. I think, you know, again, there's 30 years, you know, from the Girls Can Do Anything message that they all saw and were told that they could have everything.
But you watched Web of Chaos on Sunday night. Remember, Kate Hannah told everybody that if you were a 30-something with Instagram accounts and you like to do things like a trad wife, you were the new domestic terrorist, Marty.
Yeah.
So where do you go?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to remind everyone again, the CIA and the Rockefeller sponsored feminism, and they didn't do it to make women happier. They did it to broaden the tax base, to break up families that might form strong communities to oppose them, to accrue more power for themselves. Now those same sort of psychos are showing the same concern for Indigenous peoples, which should make them very worried, because they're doing it for the same reason, to divide, to demoralise the most likely opponents, and to accrue more power for themselves.
Yeah, indeed. We got quite a bit of feedback, which is great. Woo-hoo. Thank you. We love feedback. Feedback is wonderful. So firstly, Marie and Marty, so good to have you two back in Media Matters. Welcome back and keep up the good work. That is from Shelley. This one is from Peter. Hi, Marie. Appreciated the discussion with Marty. If sensible people in New Zealand are to move ahead, irrespective of background, we need a concise list of shared values. It is also crucial that these be prioritised. For example, an organisation may have only two values, making money and putting people first. This can frequently be in conflict. So which one actually takes priority in the day-to-day decisions? Staff and customers can tell you very, very quickly, and the same applies to a country's values. And that's from Peter. So thank you, Peter. It's really, it is quite interesting because I know that there has been a lot of emphasis, the be kind emphasis applied from Dear Leader, you know, so lots of emphasis applied on the feels, but both you and I are business owners. You've got to have a level of profit in order to be sustainable because the only other option is the government. So then, to your point, were they doing a good job and the job they meant to be doing, or were they doing a bad job when it came to failing at citizens?
It looked like they were doing a good job, but they were really doing a good job that, yeah, New Zealanders weren't aware what the job was or who they were working for.
Exactly. Good to hear my favourite Gisbonites back. Oh, you're welcome. That's love your content. That's from Paul.
Oh.
From Liz. Great to have you guys back together, Marie and Martin. I've missed you. We've missed you guys too. Dear Marie and Marty, money well spent, I reckon. I love Media Matters, one of the top shows. I want to know your thoughts about the Whangarei Boys High Board of Trustees being charged over the just so awfully sad death of the poor young man last year. And now I think that was the one with the caving.
Yeah, they went flooding caving the caves. When there was rain forecast, which was stupid. But that was kind of on the teachers more than the board. It was actually, I don't know if you read that opinion by Len Brown in the Sunday Star Times, where he talks about the movement into this obsession with safety, the Health and Safety Work Act, where things got completely disconnected from the financial impact of whatever activity was being made safe. So through fines for managers or director of companies who may not have even been closely connected to the actual activity were higher than if they had become ram raiders. And he said, safety at any cost became our nation's rule and we plunged further down the productivity rankings. Now there is fight back as people realise the costs and worries of this approach. To improve safety, teaching personal responsibility is a good start and putting realistic values on safety will help. That's pretty in line with what I think.
It is just so difficult because, of course, you know, you don't, like they highlighted here that there were concerns around going in there at that time. And it's that, you know, without knowing what the decision-making matrix was of that teacher or the school or who actually made that decision, and it's difficult. But at the end of the day, it's a tragedy, isn't it? You know, I mean, just look at what Cave Creek. There's so many different elements and,
well, the important thing is to ensure that it doesn't happen again rather than seek vengeance on, you know, the board of directors who, as Wayne Brown said, weren't necessarily directly connected to the decision.
And I think you've summed it up in your comment quite beautifully. It says here, sorry to be such a horrid subject, but it's close to my heart, the circle of community having a son and his friends a part of this tragedy. And that's just it. That these tragedies, whether it be Rory Nairn, this young man that has passed, it's a ripple effect. It affects so many more people than the loss of a single life. One single life lost actually has this entire ripple effect within their immediate family or whānau, the wider community, the school community. It goes on and on and on. And it is, it's about, as you said, learning moving forward. So, yeah.
But, I try and teach my kids that if something feels wrong, they've got every right to say back the bus up.
Well, we need to retake it.
Responsibility.
And it's we've talked about this before. We've got to retake teaching our kids the ick.
Yeah,
you know that little voice that tells them that things aren't quite right.
My consistent bit of advice I give young people who I meet who are about to travel overseas is. That if someone really wants you to do something and they're really excited about it, chances are it's not in your best interest. And listen to the ick.
Yeah, listen to the ick. Here's another one. Pass on to Marie and Marty. So great to hear their insights again. Absolutely excellent. Can't wait till next week. Hope you have a safe weekend. And that's from Mark.
Well, here we are. Hope you enjoyed it.
Here we are. I was listening to Marie and Marty earlier this week. Their work is usually very good, humorous, intelligent, informative. There's a but coming.
Uh-oh. I can feel but coming.
There is a but coming. But there was one or two statements made on Māori tikanga, traditional customs and spiritual beliefs that need correction. Police direct them to Julian's videos, part 1 to part 10, found here in an enlightened analysis of tikanga and how it's been used to undermine common law and longstanding justice, from Christopher, founding member. Christopher then sent all the links through. I likened tikanga to Māori common law. Now, I didn't say it was the law. However, and I don't disagree with you, Christopher, in terms of tikanga and where tikanga sits. And as we know, we haven't actually covered it here, but there has been quite a brouhaha, haven't used that word yet, so yeah, brouhaha, around tikanga becoming a compulsory part of lawyer training. And that's going on at the moment and entrenching it there. Now, what I do know, Christopher, is that the element of tikanga as a part, an entrenched part of the New Zealand legal framework has been going on in this country for quite a long time. And I can't, again, go into too much detail about this, but I know more about this than you might think. And ultimately, at the end of the day, and this is where the fight is now coming, and I'm quite pleased to see was it Kid standing up against this in terms of what's going on at the law schools. But you do have a number of judges who have now made judgments using tikanga as as relevant as part of the judgment. And there is now this to-ing and fro-ing that's going on. I look at tikanga as it's like a moral code, right? Ooh. And there are that sort of in any moral code, whether it be a Christian moral code or a moral code with tikanga, a lot of those moral codes are actually built into common law, because common law is common sense in a lot of cases. So, yeah, you did write some really good stuff there. Liz has got all of this information. So if anyone is listening saying, oh, okay, what's Chris talking about? And he's provided a number of YouTube videos plus some of the stuff from Julian. And we have spoken to Julian Batchelor here before on RCR. And I know some of the other hosts are going to be diving into this topic as well. Liz has got those. So if you would like to have a look at those resources that Christopher has provided, just drop Liz a line at inbox@realitycheck.radio and she can pass those on. But I just want to thank you, Christopher. You say corrections. This is really fluid, and it's more conversations. And I'm glad we're having the conversations, and that tikanga as a conversation is now getting placed out on the table, and it's not just being blindly accepted that this is part of the legal framework, even though it's been placed there by stealth for more than a decade.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. Tikanga is an interpretation and I guess codifying of rules that come out of kawa, natural law. So tikanga can vary from tribe to tribe, but kawa is more the overarching philosophical background, which probably is better compared to common law. But yeah, the thing that troubles me about tikanga being inserted into the legal framework is that it is so very subjective, and it's been somewhat captured by academics and activist judges and lawyers.
Oh, indeed.
I sat through Julian's presentation. I'm aware of most of what he talks about, and I found little to disagree with in it, except that his attitudes were maybe influenced by the troubles that he'd had with his land that led to him being interested in.
Yeah, and of course, and for listeners to know too, Marty and I both attended Hui, looking at tikanga from the other side of the equation, so which we have done in recent years. So it's an interesting subject, and it's one that, again, I'm actually quite pleased that it's now out in the wider open space, because, you know, these sorts of things need to be discussed. It's all part of the fabric of our nation.
Much better discussed as friends than adversaries. And that's what really annoys me about Te Pāti Māori's brand of communication. Yeah. That it's so angry, and it so seeks to make enemies out of those who don't necessarily need to be enemies. I mean, our common cause, before we get to any of the rats and mice of little legal arguments, should be, hey, how do we stop so many kids getting murdered? How do we improve their educational outcomes? How do we improve their overall health? And that's something that we could all get together and agree needs to be better addressed. And I would only wish that these people who are protesting mining or protesting this or that would get as angry they are about that, about the terrible time that so many children have in this country.
Well, as I said right at the very beginning, you know, the Greens are all, you know, their vision was for the planet.
Yeah.
When actually it's kind of like, you know what, anything you do in this country in regards to the planet is a flea, fart and a hurricane. It really is. And the only thing you're trying to do is preserve our virtue and your messianic narcissistic complex that you have and your position in this world. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you're dead right. What about the kids at home?
Yeah.
What about the people that need jobs? What about, you know, all of those other things? So, yeah, I think we've rounded it up. So thank you very
much. It's almost positive. All right, well, let's quit while we're ahead.
2057, of course, is the text number if you want to send us some feedback. Inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email, and you and I will do it all again next week. It'll be budget frenzy next week because, of course, the budget's out the day after our show. But you know what? There'll be, oh, God, I'll be chomping at the bit this weekend. Trying to preempt what's going to be there.
I hope that they don't do what was Matthew Hooton feared and deliver Squealer Robertson's seventh budget. That would be a wasted opportunity.
Oh, God.
Just need to get a few more functionally numerate journalists to understand the terrible state we're in that they cheered on.
I hope Derek writes something about the budget. Derek's, he's not bad.
He's good for 2,000 words.
I know. Blesses my heart. And he likes a number, does our Derek. Anyway, I digress. Hey, we'll do it all again next week. Thank you very much. And don't disappear, of course. There's a last song and coming up here on Reality Radio with Marie. And thank you again, Marty.
Thanks for all you do, Marie. And have a great week, everyone.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.